It's a nice, safe place to raise kids. So Columbine High happens. You got all these folks in April of 1999 shocked. Why? Because their privilege allowed them to let down their guard to the real dangers that existed in their community. So 2 months before that shooting happened, Klebold and Harris, the two shooters and bombers that tried to blow up their school, went into class, man, with a videotape where they acted out the murder of their classmates and teachers for a grade. Man, this was a class project, a movie they made with their camcorder where they killed everybody. 2 months early, they walk in. The teacher's like, wonderful use of light and sound and great dialogue. And now just imagine if these two black kids had walked in. There were only five at Columbine that year, but just imagine that two black kids had walked into class with a videotape where they acted out the murder of all these white people. Because that's what it would have been, because that's who was there. They'd have been killing white people. Like two black folks roll into class for a grade, they're like, yeah, teacher, this is our video, it's our movie. It's called The Day We Kill All Y'all. Hope you like it. Hope you remember that it's just a movie. I'm thinking their parents would have gotten a call, but it would have been the call that said, come get your children at the police station because we've arrested them on probability of making a terrorist threat, right? But see, these white folks were from good families. They drive nice cars. They never do anything wrong. And so they go into the Ace Hardware and they get enough explosive material to bring down a school. Black folks couldn't have done that either. Because if black folks roll up in the Ace Hardware and they're like, yeah, man, I need to get like, I don't know, 35 pipes, 15 pounds of TNT and some short fuses. Can you hook me up? The guy behind the counter is going to say, no. But they're from good families and they have money and they drive nice cars and nothing bad ever happens here. So these privileged people let down their guard, and then when it goes down, what happened? Well, I got an email from a guy who was on the SWAT team at Columbine, so I know what happened. He sends me this email, and he says, Tim, you know what? Because he'd seen some stuff I'd written about this. He said, when we got there that day, we were ready to take the building, because that's what we're trained to do. That's what we would have done in inner city Denver if this was the courthouse or a school in the city in Denver. So we're ready, man. We got our guns. We got our shields. The shots are still going off. And our commanding officer wouldn't let us charge the building and save any lives. And we looked at him like he was crazy, and we said, why? And he said, quote, these are white people with money and nice cars. And if we take this building and somebody dies because of our actions, they'll sue us blind, end of quote. So they waited, and they waited, and they waited, and eventually the shot stopped, and then they took the building. Now, it may be that they couldn't have saved any lives that day. We'll never know for sure. But isn't it ironic that the one thing that guaranteed they couldn't save anyone that day was the very same thing that that community had grown accustomed to, getting that privilege of being deferred to, being treated differently than and better than people of color could ever have expected. That's my point, that privilege, though it sets you up for a lot of advantages, it can also let you down by setting you up for a fall, by creating a false mentality of the way the world is gonna work. And that false mentality is dangerous because if you think the world works like this, and then you discover that it works like this over here, you're not ready for that. 9/11 is a perfect example of that. A global Columbine, though we have not talked about it in that sense, but we should have. Because if you watch TV after 9/11 the way I did, you might have noticed, I couldn't help but notice the difference in the way white folks and folks of color talked about it. Now don't get me wrong, everybody was scared, everybody was mad, everybody was freaking out, but only white folks ever, not all white folks did it, but only white folks ever went in front of a camera and said this, why do they hate us? Why? Why? Why would anybody hate the United States of America? I don't understand. People of color were not tripping on that, okay? Not because people of color hate the United States either, per se, but because folks of color have always had a love-hate relationship, loving certain things about it, hating other things about it, and always knowing what it is to be hated, always knowing what it is to be hunted, knowing what it is to be terrorized. We keep saying things like 9/11 changed everything. Not for everybody, because for some folks, the only thing new about September 11 was that it came from another country and not from the other side of the railroad tracks on the other side of your own town. It was only new for some people. Some people knew what it was to be attacked for who they were. White Americans were like, I don't get it. I need to go buy a book on Islam. Maybe it will explain to me. This is crazy talk. Why would somebody not like us? We're goodness and light. See, because privileged people have the luxury of never having had to worry about what someone else's perception is. If you're privileged, you don't care what other people think because you don't have to. So for all those years, the dominant group could say, what are you going to do to us? Because we're big and bad, man. We are the U.S. of A. We will, as the noted philosopher Toby Keith has said, we will put a boot in your ass because it's the American way. Didn't you hear, fool? We spend $300 billion a year on defense, so you can't mess with us because we will bomb you back into the Stone Age. And if you're already there, we'll take you back to whatever it was before the Stone Age because we can. And that's what privilege says. We can do whatever we want, and you can't touch us. And then 19 guys with, I don't know, $700 or $800 worth of plane tickets, $35 worth of box cutters, and a bone to pick said, cool, y'all spend your $300 billion a year on defense, and me and my boys are bringing these buildings down. How do you like us now? In other words, privilege didn't protect. Privilege lets you let down your guard. Privilege says, the world's like this, and the world says, wrong. The world is like this. And if privilege doesn't allow you to see that or doesn't allow you to care or allows you to think that your perception is the only one that really matters, which is what we've been living in forever in this country, you're going to find out that folks are going to die because of that nonsense. And then when privileged people finally get woken up to the real world, they say, oh, I figured it out. I know why they hate us. They hate us because of our freedoms. Which is a privileged answer, because only privileged people think they're free. Everyone else knows differently. They did not go to Pine Ridge Reservation and get that answer. Nobody went to ask the Lakotas at Pine Ridge, why do you think 9/11 happened? Because the Lakota are not going to, in front of that microphone, say, well, damn fool, it's obviously all these freedoms. They didn't go to South Chicago to get that answer, East LA to get that answer, West Philadelphia to get that answer. They didn't even go uptown to Washington Heights or Harlem to get that answer because no one in those communities would have thought of such a silly ass thing to say. But privileged people are like, it's because we're so free. Yeah. And then privileged people come up with a great solution. I know what we'll do. We'll kill a bunch of them. We'll just bomb them until they like us or until they stop. We'll make a lot of enemies, but we'll just keep killing them. That'll work. Yeah, that's what we were told. Privileged people thought it would. The racial polls before the war in Iraq were very interesting. They asked people of color, do you think this is a good idea? Nope. Folks of color were like, A, I don't think it's the right thing to do morally, and B, it's not going to work. White folks were like, let's do this. They actually asked white, it's like two-thirds said yes. Absolutely. We must do this thing. Because why? Because Don Rumsfeld says it's going to be great. Don Rumsfeld, or maybe it was Dick Cheney, after a while these white men look alike to me, but one of them said, one of them on national TV made the comment, they're going to greet us as liberators. They're going to throw rose petals at our feet because we're going to give them candy bars and Christina Aguilera CDs and other worthless crap like that. And they're going to love us because we're liberators. They're going to kiss us and name their babies George and things like this was actually said on national television. How's that working? Not so good. And I'm not saying this to be flippant, and I'm certainly not saying it to be disrespectful. I know parents who have buried their children, and I know some who sadly may end up burying their children in coming weeks and months and years because of this mentality of entitlement and this mentality of privilege, what the Greeks called hubris, the inability to see yourself the way others see you because you have such an inflated sense of your own self-righteousness as a nation or as a race or as a gender or as people with money. I mean, it goes all the way down the line. And so privileged folks have got us into this situation that we're in right now with no end in sight, and people are burying their children because of it. And I resent that for those families, and I resent that for the country, and I resent it for my children, because it's making that world that we share considerably less safe. And so on the one hand, the first victims of it are certainly people of color, not only here but around the globe. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of white folks who are going to pay the price for that privilege as well, and that inability to see the world for what it actually is. And so I would suggest that we have a real interest, even those of us in the dominant group, of rethinking our attachment to this system of inequality, whether it's domestically or whether it's globally, because at the end of the day, it doesn't serve us very well. It creates intense dangers, intense risks that we and that our children and grandchildren are going to pay. I want to close with a very quick story and then take a few questions. The story I tell you, not only because it makes a good point, but because it's good life advice. And I'm sure you came here looking for that from the likes of me. But the story I tell you because it makes a point that I think is important. A lot of times, even when we intellectually understand this stuff, it's easy for all of us. I've done it. You've probably done it. Most of us have probably done it. Gotten to that point where we say, yeah, you know, I know this is really awful. This whole history and this legacy is awful. But, you know, I just don't have time to really focus on it. I've got so many other things to deal with. And after all, I didn't create the problem. So even though I know it's awful, it's really someone else's job to fix the problem. The story I'm about to tell you, I think, explains how dysfunctional that attitude is for all of us. And the story itself has nothing to do with race, and it has nothing to do with social injustice or inequality at all. But it makes a point about that. When I got out of college, and this is why it's good life advice, because you'll be getting out soon and you'll need to know this. When I got out of college, I thought it'd be a really great idea to move into a huge house with 9 other people. I'm not sure what in the name of God I thought would be so great about this, but I'm pretty confident that it had something to do with being broke. And when you're broke, you'll do all kinds of really silly things, like move into a house with 9 other people, because it will save you money. And it did. We were renting a house that cost $525 a month. So I'm not good at math, but I can do those numbers. $52.50. And you add all the utilities and the groceries and the phone bill and all of that, still less than $100 a month. So you couldn't beat it. It was a great deal. But about 5 or 6 weeks into this process, we learned a little something about the decision that we made, which led many of us to think maybe we should have just saved our money and lived by ourselves, because it would have worked out a lot better than living with all these roommates. So I come home one night from work about 6:30, and one of my roommates is making dinner for the evening for the family, because we as a family, quote unquote, as a household, we would cook for each other. So we didn't just share expenses, we also took turns cooking. And it was his turn to cook, and that night he was cooking this big pot of gumbo for the house, because it was New Orleans and that's what you do. And man, when I hit the door, it smelled good and it looked good. And any other day I would have had some, but when he asked me if I wanted some, I said no, because I'd already eaten some dinner downtown. I told him, I said, no, I don't really want any, but I'll tell you what, why don't you just take it, put it in the fridge, put it in some Tupperware or something. I'll take some of it to work tomorrow because it looks great. He said, cool, he would. I said, great, sounds good. I'm going to go upstairs. I went upstairs. I did a little work that I was behind on. I watched some television in my room and I went to bed early. Woke up the next morning at about 7:30, went downstairs to get my coffee, get ready for work, and I noticed that on the left front burner of that stove, there was still this pot of gumbo just sitting there. And it didn't look as good and it didn't smell as good as it had the night before. It was getting all crusted to the side and nasty, and he hadn't saved any of it for me. He just sort of let it go to waste. So I was angry on 2 levels, right? 1, it had gone to waste. I certainly wasn't going to eat it now. And 2, he'd left it for somebody else to clean up. So I was a little bit mad about that. But I said, you know, I got 15 minutes before I got to hit the streetcar. I guess I'll just clean it. So I grabbed the pot of gumbo. I brought it over to the sink. I got the sponge, the brush, the gloves, the soap, and I started to run the water. And just before I actually put the pot of gumbo under the faucet, I stopped myself. And I said, wait. I don't have to clean this. I didn't make this mess. I didn't even eat any of this gumbo. I didn't have any of this. I didn't make this. I don't have to do this. Now I felt very self-righteous, you know, so I took the pot of gumbo and I put it back on the left front burner of the stove and I marched off to work. Came back that night about 6:30 and noticed that one of my other roommates was making dinner that evening on the right front burner of the stove. But on the left front burner of the stove was still this nasty, increasingly crusty, increasingly disgusting pot of uncleaned gumbo. And I looked at my roommate and I said, can you just explain one thing to me, please? Why is it and how is it that you can sit there and make tonight's dinner on the right front burner of the stove when I know you can smell last night's dinner on the left front burner because it's right underneath your left nostril? And he looked at me, because he's a smart guy because he went to college and we know that's what makes you smart. He said, Tim, I wasn't here for dinner last night. I didn't have any of the gumbo. I certainly didn't make the gumbo. And then he pointed a very accusing finger at me and asked, did you make or eat the gumbo? And I said, no, not me. And now we both felt self-righteous because we knew what the no, not me meant. It meant that we didn't have to clean it. And he said, would you like a plate of lentils and rice? And I said, yes, I would. And I took my lentils and rice, very self-righteously ate them, put the dish back in the sink, cleaned it off, put it in the dish rack, and went upstairs, did some work, watched some television, ultimately fell asleep fairly early. I woke up the next morning about 7 o'clock, and I'd forgotten to set an alarm. But let me just give you a tip, and if you don't remember another thing I said tonight, that's fine. For the love of God, remember this. If you live in a house where someone has left a pot of gumbo on the left front burner of the stove for 36 and a half hours, you will not need an alarm clock to wake you up, because the smell will crawl out of the pot of gumbo on the legs that it has grown. And now I am speaking neither in metaphor nor hyperbole. I mean it literally. It will crawl out of the pot on the legs that it's grown. It will crawl across the kitchen, across the living room, up the back stairs, down the back hall. It will go under your door frame. It will assault your nose, and you will be awake. And now I was, and I was pissed because I knew what the smell meant. I knew what was waiting for me on the left front burner of that stove. So I run out of my room, and I run down the hall. Remember, I live with 9 other people. Can't find one of them. And the guy that made the gumbo is like Bin Laden. Nobody knows where in the hell he is. It's like he made the gumbo as a practical joke, just to see how long it would take for someone else to clean it and then skip town. So I get to the bottom of the stairs. I look across the living room. I look into the kitchen. I see the gumbo. And the gumbo, I am fairly certain, saw me. And it was at that moment, not a moment earlier, but also not a moment later, that I learned the most important lesson I had learned up to that point or since. And that was this: it didn't really matter whether I had made the mess. It didn't really matter whether I was responsible for that. It didn't matter whether I was, as the saying goes, the author of all this unpleasantness. The only thing that mattered was that I was tired of living in the funk. And the same is true with human societies. When we get tired of living in the funk, when we get tired of that legacy that we have inherited, whether we wished for it or not, whether we would have it as our own or not, were it up to us, then we'll get busy doing the work, not because we are to blame for the situation we find ourselves in, but because we are here and there is no one else to do the work. And so at the end of the day, if we don't want our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren to have to come back and have the same conversations, as tiring as they can be and as exhausting as they can be, then we must do the work now as if our lives depended on it, because at the end of the day, they probably do. Thank you very much, and God bless. Take care. I think the bigger question is, what do you all think? Because the danger in this society is that too often we rely on the so-called expert, whether it's the professor, the politician, the theorist or analyst, to come up with solutions for us, when in fact, when we're talking about big social problems like racism or, you know, any other system of inequality or oppression, those kinds of problems require the answers that only come from collective thought and collective struggle. So if you look even at the history of what's been accomplished thus far in this country with the civil rights movement, with the women's movement, with the labor movement, with all the movements that have made the gains they've made, as minimal as those are in the larger scheme of things, none of those solutions, none of those actions came about because some expert got up and said, here's the 5 things we need to do. In fact, was quite the opposite. In the civil rights movement, you had a handful of people who had a lot of experience saying, you know what? A lot of us older heads don't know the answers. We don't really know our ass from our elbow. We need to get a lot of young people together who have the energy, who have the time, who have the passion. Maybe they don't have the experience, but we trust that they can get it right. And so Ella Baker, who had been around for a long time doing this work, had been with NAACP, left the NAACP, had been with Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, left them as well, because she viewed both of those groups as too male-dominated and too hierarchical. In 1960, said, you know what we need to do is get a group of young people. So she helps to call this initial conference of what became the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And SNCC ended up being really the premier anti-racism and civil rights organizing group in this country. And it was made up of people whose average age was going to be the same as the average age of students and, well, the average age of people in this room, if you were to average them all out, somewhere between late teens and mid-20s, with some people in their late 20s, a young bunch of folks. And they got together and they would spend 8 hours in a church basement if they had to come up with real solutions for the problems that plagued them. So I think when I say, what do you think the answer is? I guess what I'm really saying is you need to look around, look at the institutions in the community where you live, look at the college you attend or the community where you live or the place where you work or whatever else the case might be, and figure out where are the pressure points, where are the places where racism and privilege may be entering in, not on purpose. I think the first thing to do is look for the not obvious stuff. The obvious stuff is going to make itself apparent to you, you know, but I'm talking about the subtleties, the way that people get jobs in this country, overwhelmingly through networking and connections, doesn't have anything to do with merit, and it tends to lock out people of color disproportionately, it locks out women disproportionately, locks out working people. So that means when you're out there in the world of work, what can you do to try to figure out a way to open up that opportunity to folks who otherwise might not be in the know, in the network for certain jobs? It means when it comes time for college admissions, looking at the evaluation standards that we're using to determine whether or not they're really about merit, and whether or not they may be racially disproportionate against certain folks or disparate, gender disparate, class disparate. We know, for example, that standardized test scores are really quite absurd way to judge merit, let alone to produce fairness, because we have an educational system that quite deliberately is unstandardized. We actually brag about that. We say, that's what makes us different than the rest of the world. We don't have big government doing all the education, yeah, like all the countries that kick our ass in every competition that we compete in, who all fund their education primarily through big government and actually have much better outcomes. We brag about being unstandardized. We brag about being decentralized, and then we give every student the same tests to get into college. That's nonsensical. You have unstandardized kids with unstandardized schools, you give them a standardized test, that's the definition of unfairness. And then if a college uses those test scores and uses those academic indicators to determine who's coming and who's not, they are perpetuating injustice, whether they intend to do it or whether they don't. I think the best thing I can tell folks in a college setting is look at the mission statement of your school, particularly a school like this, because the mission statement here is this lovely, beautiful set of ideas. It's wonderful. A lot of schools, not nearly as flowery, but you know, this is like, I mean, there's stuff in there about social justice and stuff about, oh my God, global citizenship and all. I mean, you know, it's been a while since I looked at it. It was several months ago, but it's nice stuff, really good stuff. And it seems to me like if colleges are going to have these mission statements, which basically say, this is why we exist, this is the reason for which we are here, right, then it seems to me that we ought to be able, if we're a member of that institution, we ought to be able to demand that every policy, every practice, and every procedure that takes place within that setting works toward that end. And anything that contradicts that end is gone. And anything that supports that end is done. And so that means, frankly, that we've got to figure out ways to operationalize the mission statements of our schools. Most schools, think about it. You know, these schools have these mission statements all about social justice, but how many of you, to become a student here, were actually asked about that? How many of you had to actually provide an answer as to what does this mission mean to you? How have you lived it in the past? How do you intend to live it now? And if you don't give a good enough answer, you don't get in. Test scores notwithstanding, grades notwithstanding. Nobody had to answer that kind of question in order to get in. No faculty member had to explain the importance of that mission statement in order to get a faculty gig. And no faculty member looking for tenure had to prove that they'd done work in keeping with that mission statement in order to get tenure either. And no staff member who got hired had to demonstrate that the mission statement meant anything to them at all. That seems to me like what we're really saying is, here's what we're about, but we're not going to actually see to it that the people who are members of our institution even know what it is, let alone have a commitment to it. That's utterly inconsistent. It seems to me schools ought to be able to say, if this is why we're here, you ain't coming unless this matters to you and unless you can explain why it matters to you. And there are a lot of schools out there, you don't like that, pick another one. And so I think we start with the mission of why the school exists and say that we ought to have requirements. Obviously not retroactive. You can't go back and say, I know you're like 4 hours from graduating, but surprise. But we can certainly say for people who are coming in now, here's what we mean. You tell us why this matters to you. And by the way, once you get in, you're going to have to prove that it matters to you by virtue of something, whether it's service learning, whether it's an academic project that keeps with this principle. I mean, something. I think, you know, that's the kind of thinking we've got to bring to bear, that we're really talking about transforming institutions using the institution's own stated principles and making sure that everything from hiring to tenure to admissions to recruitment to financial aid actually reflects that mission. Those would be a few places to start, but beyond that, that's something you all will have to have a long conversation about. Other questions? Yes. I was. Oh, my God. I thought that looked like me. In the interview with John Stossel to rebut Shelby Steele, they showed 0 minutes and 0 seconds of my rebuttal, which goes to show you that liberal media bias really at work at ABC. He got the last word, which was unfortunate. But for those who didn't see the interview, I mean, it was an interview about white privilege. I made the case as well as they would allow me to, that there was such a thing, and then they actually, to their credit, they showed several clips of studies they had done or that they were referring to that clearly demonstrated white privilege in everything from the resume test that I mentioned with the names at the top to shopping to looking for cars, looking for apartments, all of it demonstrating it. And then they interviewed Shelby Steele, who's a very prominent black conservative with the Hoover Institution and also teaches at Berkeley, I guess. And Shelby Steele's argument, very similar to black conservative argumentation elsewhere, is that whether there is white privilege or racism or not really isn't the point. He actually said racism was about the 18th most important thing affecting black people today. I'd love to know what 1 through 17 were. They didn't ask him for a list, but he just said this like it was gospel truth, and then said whether it is or whether it isn't, the real issue is black irresponsibility, was the phrase that he used. And he said, you know, 70% out of wedlock birth rates, blah, 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 that's our real problem. And what I said when Stossel asked me about it, I said, well, first of all, even if I accepted Shelby Steele's argument at face value, and I don't, it's horribly wrong, but even if I granted everything he says about quote-unquote black irresponsibility, what does that have to do with white privilege? The fact is, if white folks have unearned advantage solely because we're white, then whatever black folks do or don't do doesn't change that. It seems to me like if we want to have a fair system, my responsibility, since after all, Shelby Steele saying we should all take personal responsibility, that's his shtick. That's his mantra. That's Bill Cosby's thing. That's what all these folks are saying. Personal, cool, I'm with that. Personal responsibility means white folks got to deal with our piece, right? We got to deal with our two dimes in the quarter, so to speak. So even if you want to say black folks have got a nickel in that quarter too, or a couple nickels in the quarter, or whatever the case might be, and got to deal with their stuff, I'm saying, fine, what are we supposed to deal with? St. Paddy's Day and Oktoberfest? What the hell is my job? Like, it seems to me, white folks' job is to deal with racism in our community, to deal with unearned privilege. And whether or not people of color do their piece doesn't absolve us from doing ours, just like I assume Shelby Steele would say, whether or not white privilege or racism goes away, we as black people have to work hard, have to play by the rules, cool. Okay, if black folks can't use white people as an excuse, then white people can't use black folks as an excuse. But all these prophets of personal responsibility use it as a weapon against black people. So my position is principally that, although I would also point out that some of the things that Steele was saying were just flatly inaccurate and distorted. So this whole thing about, you know, the black quote-unquote underclass, first of all, white privilege principally affects not the underclass. I mean, ultimately, white privilege is the thing that takes black middle-class folks and puts them at a disadvantage versus white middle-class folks. White privilege is the thing that allows white folks who have $15,000 a year in annual income, technically at the poverty line, to have a greater chance of owning their own home than black families with $42,000 a year in annual income, because the white working-class family might have inherited a home from a parent or grandparent. Nothing fancy, but an intergenerational wealth transfer. White privilege is the thing, and I pointed this out, and I wish they had broadcast it. Shelby Steele's got a brother named Claude. Claude and Shelby don't speak. The reason Claude and Shelby don't speak is because Claude Steele agrees with the idea that racism is prevalent and has actually done research to demonstrate it. Shelby Steele writes books where he says, I was at a cocktail party and one of my colleagues said that his black students don't work very hard. And I said, yes, that sounds familiar to me. That's not research. His brother Claude does research where he's demonstrated the effect of racial stereotypes on students of color and how racial stereotypes are able to actually undermine performance irrespective of level of preparation, because if you're a person who labors under a stereotype and you're taking a test or you're trying to compete against people who are viewed as superior, just the knowledge that your performance could be viewed through the lens of that stereotype is enough to create additional stress and anxiety and drive down performance. And he's proven it over and over again. So I said, you know, I'm glad Shelby Steele thinks there's no problem. I wish we'd spoken to his brother, who's actually done research to demonstrate that there is. They didn't broadcast that. The only one last thing I would say is the 70% out of wedlock birth rate thing, that even though it has nothing to do with the issue of white privilege, even if it were true, the problem with this data, everybody who hears this data says that that's evidence of irresponsibility among black people. Let me be real clear. You need to know this, because this is the way data gets thrown around, totally out of context. The fact that, actually it's 67%, the fact that 67% of African-American children born today are born out of wedlock has absolutely zero to do with irresponsible sexual behavior among black single parents. And here's why this is true. It sounds counterintuitive. You would think, well, of course, it's because they're not being responsible. But here's actually the deal. 80% of the increase in out-of-wedlock childbirth in the black community comes from one factor alone. And that factor is that black couples are having fewer children, right? So think about this. If black married couples are having fewer children, then by definition, the children who are being born are going to be increasingly, as a percentage of the whole, are going to be out of wedlock. But it's not because single black folks are having more sex out of wedlock, unprotected sex, being irresponsible. In fact, the actual fertility rate among single black women has dropped consistently for 40 years. The teen birth rate among black women is at the lowest point it's been since 1929. So it's not because black women or black men are being more irresponsible. Just imagine if you had a community of 200 people, and of that 200 people, only like 10 babies were born. Or not even that, 5 babies were born in a given year. And let's say that only one of them was to a married couple and 4 were to single women. Well, that would mean that 80% of your births were out of wedlock, but it was only 5 people out of, let's say, 100 single people and 100 married people or whatever. So the actual idea that this indicates black irresponsibility isn't true. And the other part of the increase is explained by the way that the Census Bureau counts children out of wedlock now. Prior to 1981, the standard was that if you lived in an extended family, let's say you were a single mom living with your mom, living with an uncle, living with an aunt, living with a grandmother, you were previously not counted as a separate family unit. You were not counted as a separate household. It was all one extended family. After 1981, the Census Bureau began to break you out of the totals. So after 1981, if I'm a single mom living with my mom, right, which happened statistically at a fairly large amount within black and Latino spaces, within black and Latino communities, all of a sudden those folks are now being caught in the data as out of wedlock parents. They wouldn't have been caught previously in the data because they weren't seen and counted separately. So this idea that this, you know, out of wedlock child birth rate indicates something about black irresponsibility is completely wrong. Almost all of the increase that we've seen comes from, you know, one, changing the statistical method that we use to count them, and two, the drop in child bearing among married black couples, which simply boosts the overall percentage of out of wedlock up, even though the fertility rates among unmarried black women have dropped, even though the teen birth rates have dropped. So, you know, if we're going to have these impressions given by data, we need to be clear about what the data does and doesn't say. So I think Shelby's argument is both inaccurate, but it's also irrelevant to this larger issue of white privilege. Let me take one more if there is one.
One, because we're going to give you an opportunity to come talk with Tim, and if you'd like to purchase his book, we have some books on the table here for you. So, last question.
Having served in the military and done my part overseas, I'd like to hear your comments on John Kerry's comments the other day about education and service in the military.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, for those who didn't hear the question, he was saying that as someone who'd served overseas in the military, he was curious about my views on John Kerry's comments about education in the military, which were made the other day. I think that it's just so obvious. I mean, I don't like John Kerry. I mean, make no mistake about it. I never liked him. I never thought he was a particularly capable candidate or particularly good at making the case that he wanted to make. But I don't think there's any question. In fact, if you read the part of his comments that was not reported on talk radio and wasn't reported on Fox News and wasn't reported anywhere in the network, he went on to say things in that comment which made it very clear that he was talking about people who aren't educated enough or who aren't smart enough get stuck in terms of the policies that they put forward. He wasn't referring, if you look at the context of his comments, as he said, however clumsily he may have said it, he wasn't referring to the men and women in uniform. What I think is worst about the comment, though, or the uproar to the comment, is really and truly, what is more disrespectful of the troops? Even if he said exactly what they think he said, even if he said exactly what Rush Limbaugh swears he said, even if he says exactly what Fox News insists that he meant, what's more disrespectful? To make the case that the military increasingly relies on folks who are desperate for employment, which has statistically been true for a generation and a half or two generations now, or is it more disrespectful to send people into battle on the basis of material you know to be a lie, that every intelligence agency in the world says is exaggerated, that the people on the ground doing the inspection says is wrong, to send them without enough armor, and then Don Rumsfeld stands up and says, well, you go to battle with the troops you have, so get over it, which is what he says in front of a group of troops when they question him on why they don't have enough armor. It seems to me that what is more disrespectful is to send people into harm's way on the basis of a lie, and then when they continue to believe that lie, 82% of people in uniform right now, according to data, polls that were taken last year, actually believe that they are in Iraq to avenge Saddam Hussein's role in 9/11. So you got men and women being shot at, and I don't think they're stupid. I think they bought a lie because they were told that. They've been lied to that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, for which there isn't one shred of evidence anywhere in existence, except in the fevered imagination of a handful of people at Fox. And these men and women are being shot at and dying, and they believe that. And that's what's disrespectful. So whether even if John Kerry had meant to insult the intelligence of soldiers, which seems a bit silly, and it seems really odd for guys that never served in uniform to get all upset about it on the part of a guy who did, the reality is that what this administration has done by sending them there in the first place on the basis of information that any credible person had to know was wrong, and that unfortunately both Democrats and Republicans believe was true, because they wouldn't listen to the arms inspectors, and they wouldn't listen to Scott Ritter, and they wouldn't listen to the people who've been there, that's what's disrespectful, and that's what's getting people killed. And what's really disrespectful is to spend 20 years giving weapons to the guy who you then go to war against, so that whatever weapons he does have are the ones that you gave him. I mean, that's disrespectful too. And so maybe if we stopped funding tyrants, arming tyrants, supporting dictators, supporting people like Saddam Hussein for 20 years, then we wouldn't have to worry about the blowback that always ends up killing troops who had nothing to do with those decisions. Those decisions to arm people like that are made by folks who've never themselves served. Don Rumsfeld was in on that under the Reagan administration, and it was those of us on the left who frankly said that we shouldn't have been giving Saddam Hussein weapons all those years, and it was folks on the right who said, oh, but we must, we must, we must, and then, my God, he has weapons of mass destruction. Well, if he does, I know where he got them, and if he doesn't, then what the hell are we doing? And not to mention, there's this larger issue, frankly, of why it is that we think we have the right to dictate which countries around the world can have weapons of mass destruction and which ones can't. I will assure you that that kind of mentality that says we get to pick and choose the nuclear powers and we get to tell you who can have chemical weapons and we can have them and our allies can have them, anybody we say, they can have them, the world thinks that that's a crock, and the world is not really going to sit by and allow the United States to dictate the terms of who can have what. If we want to get rid of ours, which is what the Non-Proliferation Treaty says we have to do, and we've never followed it, and we get mad when everyone else breaks it, we don't follow it, our allies don't follow it, then we can talk. But until then, the world is going to view us as supreme hypocrites, and we're going to be endangered. And unfortunately, more men and women in uniform are going to get killed, and more innocent civilians are probably going to be killed on both sides, because the policies we're going to follow are going to be just disastrous and deadly. And I think the people that send folks into harm's way on the basis of that kind of an argument are the ones who are really being the most disrespectful, not folks like Kerry, as disrespectful as he was too, because he voted for the war. So he's responsible for those decisions. But his comments were hardly as offensive as the vote that he himself cast, along with a lot of his colleagues, to start this thing in the first place.